Would like to once again introduce Michael, referring to a fact that perhaps some of you aren't aware. When just before Jesus Christ's ascension in Acts 1:8, he tells us, or Luke tells us, that he turned to his disciples and he said, "You're going to be my witnesses, both here in Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth." And as we've been studying for almost 2 years now, the book of Acts, we see that in that generation, they reached the known world. Well, believe it or not, an idea entered Christianity in the subsequent centuries, that message was for that generation. And a darkness fell upon a lot of the world. Now, I'm not saying nobody took the gospel anywhere. Clearly, some did. But by the days of the Reformation and the succeeding century, the idea of sending missionaries anywhere had pretty well just died out. And it really took a movement of God that was transatlantic in nature. The preaching and teaching of men like Jonathan Edwards and George Whitefield, the Wesleys. It took a young man who was never educated after the age of 12 named William Carey, but who had a precocious mind and could learn languages, who taught himself Latin, and then taught himself Greek, and then while learning to be an apprentice cobbler and finally maturing to the point where he was a real cobbler, beginning to expand on his language ability until ultimately he taught himself Hebrew and French and Italian and Dutch, and really got burdened for the lost people in the places that the ships were coming back to England and talking about, and began building little globes out of scraps of leather that were in the cobbler shop, and determining how many millions of people lived here and here and here, and then praying earnestly for those individuals. He came under the influence of some particular, some would say peculiar, Baptists. John Ryland was a correspondent of John Newton, baptized him and ordained him into the Baptist ministry. He preached from Isaiah 54, verses 2 and 3, what's known as the Deathless Sermon. He read a passage right after the passage Brother Mike read out of Isaiah 52, 53. He read a passage that reads thusly, "Enlarge the place of your tent, and let the curtains of your habitations be stretched out. Do not hold back. Lengthen your cords and strengthen your stakes." And from that, the Holy Spirit convicted him, you know, we ought to send missionaries to the world and tell the heathen about Christ. He shared that with some of his Baptist brethren, and the majority opinion was, when God wants to save the heathen, he'll save them, with or without you. See, they really didn't believe in it. And kind of the subtext of that was, well, if you think somebody ought to go, why don't you go? And he did. And William Carey went to India. He's probably the most famous Englishman ever to go to India and is revered to this day in India for his work. It's a worthy biography to consider. At the end of the Deathless Sermon, he kept returning to this phrase, which he repeated again and again and again. Expect great things from God. Attempt great things for God. That's a good word for us today. Brother Michael, come and share with us your burden, your family's burden, for the lost heathen of Ireland.
All right, well, thank you again for giving me an opportunity just to come and speak to you a little bit about Ireland and a place that I have grown to love and to cherish, and I think a place that both my heart and Ashley's heart are already there. We're just waiting for our bodies to catch up. So this is a little bit what we're going to be talking about, who we are. You can see a picture of my family there, or you can turn that way and see my actual family right there. My name is Michael Reza Emadi. My dad is an Iranian. He was born in Iran and moved to the States when he was almost 20 in 1978. He went to college at the University of Idaho, and where he met my mom. So my dad is an Iranian, my mom is an Idahoan, and they got together, and neither one were Christians When they met, my dad would have been a nominal Muslim at best. My mom would have been a nominal Christian at best. And it probably wasn't long after I was born. I was maybe one or two, I think, that we were living in kind of like a duplex. And every night, by God's grace, there was a man who had graduated from Master Seminary. And every night, he would tell them Bible stories out on their porch. And one day, he told my dad, he said, "If I show you that Jesus is God, will you believe it?" And my dad said, "No." So the man said, "Well, I'm not going to show you then." And that kind of irritated my dad. And he wanted to know. Well, while he's telling the stories, my mom is kind of standing in the background. And she became converted. She became a Christian, listening to this man tell stories. And so she went to church, and she came back one Sunday and told my dad and said, "Just come with me one time and I'll never ask you again." And so my dad went the next time, and the pastor was preaching from the shortest verse in the Bible, John 11:35, Jesus wept. And it was from that sermon that my dad became a Christian. He became so, he just wanted to find out, how does this story end? And so he went home and finished reading the book of John and became a Christian from that. So I'm very thankful that I got to grow up in a Christian home. When I just gotten out of kindergarten, we moved to Utah. And that is where I spent most of my life. So the culture that I know, the people that I know, are all Mormon. Mormonism was my home. That is what I know. That is what I grew up in. Even though we weren't Mormons, all my friends were Mormon. I had very few Christian friends. The church that we attended was very small. It had maybe 20 people or so, and it made us a very close family. And so it was nice that we had a little family amongst the Utah, which is 95-96% Mormon. But one thing that did, growing up there, is it helped me to really make distinctions and see the dividing line between what is true and what is false. Because if you've ever talked to Mormon missionaries who come to your door, they will use the same language we use. They'll talk about grace, salvation, Jesus, and all of this. But they will mean something entirely different than what we mean by it. And so it was helpful just to start to develop an apologetic mindset, I guess, if you will, to start thinking about how do you defend the faith and what you believe. I was baptized when I was 9 years old. But though from about 9 years old to about the time that I was halfway through college, maybe almost done with college, I went to the University of Utah. I liked going to church. I loved to hear preaching, but it wasn't a big concern of mine. I didn't really have a passion to study the Bible. I had a passion for basketball. Basketball was my life. It was my family's life. If you were ever into the NBA, back in the days when John Stockton and Karl Malone were probably Utah Jazz, it was back in the good days of basketball. That is what we did. That is our lives surrendered around basketball. And that was the focus. And so in college, at University of Utah, I graduated with a degree, a BA in political science and a minor in Farsi, the Persian language. I wanted to learn Farsi because half my family speaks another language, and when they would come visit, they would talk and then say your name and laugh. And you always want to know, why are they laughing up and saying my name? So just to be able to talk with them, I learned Persian. But I also, the last 2 years, was a part of the Air Force ROTC program. And I commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Air Force. And it was very close after I commissioned. I was playing basketball one day, got hit and fell to the ground and slipped a disc in my back and ended up having to have back surgery. This would have been about 2005. Ended up having back surgery, and to recoup, all I could do was lie in bed. And so I was pretty much in bed for 4 weeks with nothing to do, and I happened to pick up a book by a guy named James White. I don't know if you're familiar with James White. He's the director of Alpha and Omega Ministries down in Phoenix. There's a book called The Potter's Freedom, a book that is a solid defense of God's sovereignty over everything. I picked up this book and I read it and I thought, this is the most amazing book that I have read. And it lit something in me, it lit a fire in me, because I all of a sudden I wanted to start reading the Bible and thinking, man, if this is true, this is what I need to be pursuing. This is so fascinating. This is who God really is. And so I read his book, and then I picked up another book by him called Debating Calvinism. It was a dialogue between James White and Dave Hunt. And after I finished that book, I realized that Dave Hunt was entirely wrong, didn't have a clue of what the text said, and James White was right, that God was sovereign. And that just lit a fire in me to read everything I could. And so from lying in bed, not being able to move, I started to read anything I could. I would be reading my Bible, I'd be grabbing Puritans, I'd be looking at the footnotes of who James White was quoting and trying to get those books to read them. So I'd be reading Puritans and all these Reformed people, and it just started to build a passion in me. Well, I ended up commissioning a second lieutenant. I was an intelligence officer. I was sent first to San Angelo, Texas for intel school. There was a very small church there, maybe 15 people on a good Sunday, and it was at that church, the pastor, who's an older gentleman who had some heart trouble, and he asked me one day if I would preach for him. I told him, no, I couldn't do that. It's too scary. So I said no, so he said okay. So he kept pressing me. I kept saying no until finally I said, okay, I'll help. And I preached one Sunday. He was very encouraging. The people were very encouraging, and I started to be thinking about seminary. Well, from San Angelo, I get sent to Misawa, Japan. Misawa, Japan, I did a very interesting job. I worked in a room with no windows, and I worked 1 month. I would work 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., and then the next month, I'd work 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., and I'd flip-flop back and forth for my time there. It was very interesting, but that's about all I can tell you, so I'll let you just ponder about things that were done there. But while I was there, I had no church. There was just nothing there. And in God's grace, James White was my guiding light. I trusted him. And so even days when I would work 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., on the days that I got off, I would keep that time. I would stay up. It'd be 3 in the morning. I'd be having lunch. And all I would do would be read and listen to sermons online, listening to James White's Dividing Line, an internet broadcast that he has. And I would just try to consume everything that I can. Well, the Air Force was going into debt. The new F-22 Raptors would cost them money, so the Air Force said, we're basically going to fire people. We're going to rack and stack you and cut the bottom percent, and you got to go, unless you volunteer to get out. And so I saw this as my opportunity to get out and pursue seminary. James White previously had on his show, his internet show, two gentlemen, Sam Waldron and Richard Barcellus, and he introduced him as the dean of Midwest Center for Theological Studies. And so because James White spoke highly of these men, I thought, well, I'll go check out their seminary. So got out of the Air Force, moved from Misawa, Japan to Kentucky. There's culture shock going both ways there. Going to Kentucky and went to Owensboro Heritage Baptist Church, which is where we are now, started seminary. Finished seminary, actually had to transfer halfway through to Reformed Baptist Seminary, which is where I have my Master's of Divinity from. Because at that time, the curriculum for the Midwest Center was not complete, and you had to transfer. So finished up seminary and really had a desire to study biblical languages. That studying the languages really just pricked an interest in me. And so in God's grace, I was given a full ride scholarship to move to Houston and go to Houston Baptist University and get another master's degree in biblical languages. So it was a year and a half of doing nothing but studying Greek, Hebrew, Aramaic, linguistics, and Latin. And I loved every second of it, and it was wonderful. While I was in while I was in Owensboro, Ashley, my wife, was coming back from college. Hopefully I'll tell this story right. I guess in volleyball, you have retractable poles that hold up the nets, and it didn't contract in the hook, and it shot out and hit her in the head. And did it give you a concussion?
Yeah.
It gave her a concussion. She was in the hospital. And so because of this injury, it has to move back to Owensboro. And so we're kind of both there. We meet, and it was irritation at first sight, I think, and frustration. And the short story, I guess, is we didn't really like each other or weren't too fond of each other anyway. And it was only after we kept getting put into circumstances with each other, we realized there was more than just, irritation. What's that?
Lies.
That's right. So that's the short version, but we started going out in May 2008, and we were married November of 2008. You can see our three kids. Liam is our oldest, is 4. Lorelai is pink. Lorelai is 3. She's always wearing pink. Is she wearing pink now, Lorelai? And our youngest is Maeve, 7 months. Quickly, just about Ireland, how this came about. When I first moved to Owensboro, I told the pastor, Sam Waldron, I said, I have two interests, Iran and Ireland, because my dad is from Iran. And Ireland, all I can say is it's just a God-given interest. I remember being in elementary school, maybe 5th, 6th grade, and just wanting to watch documentaries about Ireland, finding it fascinating. And so I told him I have two interests, Ireland and Iran. And he said, well, we can't get you into Iran, but we know a pastor in Ireland. Why don't you call him up and see if you can spend some time with them? So I spent 6 weeks in Ireland. Came back, told Ashley, who was my girlfriend at the time, and said, you know, if God would allow me to do anything to serve him, I would love to go back to Dundalk and work with Stephen Murphy. That was the last I said of it, never thought of it happening again. That was back in 2008. January of 2012, I get an email from Stephen Murphy, and he says, what would you think about moving to Ireland to come and help out our church and help plant a church? So Ashley and I really had to consider and pray and think about, is this what God is calling us to do? And decided this is where we feel like we're being led to go. So a little bit about Ireland. You can see the pink outline on Ireland there. That's what I'm referring to when I talk about Ireland. The white up in the northeast is Northern Ireland, and that's a part of the UK. That's still a part of Britain. So Ireland, when I talk about it, is the Republic of Ireland, outlined there in pink there. Ireland has roughly 4.5 million souls and is roughly 32,600 square miles. What does that mean for us? It's about the size of Indiana. So Indiana is 35,000 square miles and 6.5 million souls. So it's basically Indiana floating in the ocean as an island. That's why when they don't understand when they call, I have a friend whose aunt is in Ireland, she'll call here and she'll say, well, how's the weather in America? Well, you can ask that in Ireland, but you can't ask that about America. Depends on where you are. We've got everything going on at the same time. All right, the spiritual state of Ireland. Ireland has just reached 1% of their population is evangelical. Now, that's taking evangelical in the broadest sense that you possibly can. Under this banner is groups that we would not even consider have a biblical gospel, like the health and wealth gospel, prosperity gospel. And that's after 40 years of intense evangelism. 1% of their population is evangelical. Now, what I've done is I've taken just a few countries that I thought we send missionaries to, and I wanted to compare it. Where does Ireland fall in with this? So here's just a couple. Angola, 22% of their population is evangelical. Ethiopia is 18%. Malaysia, 3.5%. Egypt, 3.5%. India, 1.5%. Mongolia, 1.5%. Oman, 0.8%. And Niger, 0.14%. So where does Ireland fall in between these countries where we send missionaries? In between Mongolia and Oman. There are less Christians percentage-wise in Ireland than there are in India. And I don't think we realize that. And that 1% I think is deceptive because that's including groups who are health and wealth guys, prosperity gospel guys. You know, it includes just so broad Mormons and things like that. So less than 1%. But less Christians than India, Mongolia, Egypt, Malaysia, Ethiopia. And these are where we focus a lot of our missionary efforts to. So 1% is evangelical. There are 120 plus towns with no evangelical presence at all. That means no church and no Christians that anybody even knows of. There exists roughly one church for every 17,520 people. I heard a stat a couple months ago in the U.S., there's roughly one church for every 1,000 people. In Ireland, there's one for every 17,520 people. But again, that doesn't tell the whole story because some of these churches are going to be the prosperity gospel, health and wealth gospel. And there are a growing number of people who are following Neo-Druidism and New Age mysticism. This picture here of the car, or this van, is a fortune teller who comes during festivals in this little village called Carlingford. And in Carlingford, this is something that's taken seriously. It's not, you know, the fortune teller, it's something silly. This is very serious. You go to this person, expect to be told your fortune. And a friend of mine who lives in the village, he wanted to talk to her, and he said, it's the weirdest thing, but just being there, you feel this presence of evil around you. All right, so we're going to see, this is Stephen Murphy, the pastor of Dundalk Baptist Church. And what I wanted to do is give you, let you be able to hear an Irish voice. Instead of me telling you about Ireland, I want you to let you hear an Irish voice tell you a little bit about Ireland. So we're going to see if this is going to work here. Oh, wait, you said I could just push it and it will go through. Let's try.
And like if you ask most people, you know, what does Jesus Christ require of you? You'd more than likely get a blank stare. You know, they regard him as sort of a figure of history who has something to do with religion, and that's about it. But in terms of the impact on their lives, they don't expect there to be any impact on their lives. So you're starting at the most basic level where you really try to engage with people that being a Christian is, it's an all-of-life thing.
Let's let me go ahead and do the need for the gospel, and then I'll make some comments.
Understand the gospel to be good news. In other words, it actually makes a difference in a positive sense. Most people don't know that they need a difference in a positive sense. So, like, to use my own example, you know, I was brought up, and it was only when I was at third level education that I actually started to read the Bible, that I actually heard the good news of who Jesus really is, of the fact that I needed to be converted, that there is that promise of eternal life. You know, the absolute ABCs of the gospel. You know, I managed to reach 23, 24 without hearing that in a quote-unquote Christian country.
So you know, that's kind of his testimony. So here's a country that we in America kind of view, oh, well, it's Christianized, you know, it has the gospel. Here's a gentleman who reaches the age of 23, 24 before he ever even hears a presentation of the gospel. He reaches his mid-20s before he's ever heard it. And hopefully you heard him say, you know, most people that you talk to, they don't even have a fundamental basis to which to have a gospel conversation. The ABCs of the gospel, of the Bible itself, they do not know. They may talk about, well, Jesus was a good person, but that's it. You can't have a deep conversation because they don't have even that grounding in a country that we think is Christian. All right, let me play for you what he says on missions here.
Our focus of mission has become a little bit more materialistic because in some of these countries like Africa, there are genuine material needs there, and that's much more obvious and in your face. But yet, the key dynamic of mission is surely spiritual. You know, that if people are in a first world country, which Ireland and Western Europe definitely is, it's still a spiritual desert compared to some of these other countries. You know, and if we see that the focus of mission is essentially spiritual, you know, the fact that people here are not starving in the streets or there's not a civil war happening and it's not going to make the news on CNN or whatever, surely biblically our definition of missionary need should be essentially spiritual. How are these people hearing the gospel? Are there enough local churches there, indigenous churches, so that we can say, you know, the people in that country have a genuine opportunity to hear the gospel? And in Ireland, I don't think we can. Well, I know we can't.
I think that's very important, what he said. Hopefully you can hear that. He's asking, what is the basis for which we do missions? Is it physical or is it spiritual? You know, a lot of times we look to these countries where I can take a picture of somebody living in a grass hut, show it to you, and say, look how different this person is than us. Don't they need the gospel? Look, they're living in a grass hut. They barely have any clothes. They need the gospel. All the while in their country, they may have 22% of their population is evangelical. In Ireland, I can take a picture and show it to you, and they'll look a lot like us. But spiritually, they are dead. They are dead. There are not enough churches and not enough Christians to do the work of missions or evangelism there. So what is the basis for which we are viewing mission work? Is it physical or is it spiritual? And it must be spiritual. For sake of time, I'm going to go ahead and skip the last audio. It's just, what can we do in the U.S.? He talks about, you know, prayer, obviously, and also to be thinking about, based on it, if the need is spiritual and that is where we're looking to missions, more people to do work in places like Ireland because it is just so dead and that we are in need of people. And it's hard. It's hard because Americans don't think about Ireland as a missions ground. While we were there, Ashley and I think back in 2010, we were at a prayer meeting on Wednesday night. And one of the ladies prayed and she said, not that Ashley and I were there, but she said, thank you, God, that you have not forgotten this little black dot on the map of the world. How can Ireland compare with India? It's a little island, 4.5 million souls. How does that compare with India, the Middle East, with Africa? It's a little black dot on the map of the world. And I think that is many of the Christians, that is how they feel. Because we, you know, the big U.S., we look everywhere but there. And so just a plead for to think, you know, where is their spiritual deadness?
Obviously.
Whoops, there we go. These three pictures, images here, are what I think kind of capture the spiritual state of Ireland. We're going to go through each one here very briefly. So here is the first one. This is a statue of Mary. I took this in 2008 in what I call Mary Parks. I don't know what they're officially called, but I call them Mary Parks. It's a nice little area, very green. You walk down a little hill, and at the bottom of the hill are stone benches. And on these benches, people come, and they'll sit, and they'll pray to Mary as they look at this statue, and they'll pray to her. And so Catholicism is still a part of Ireland. It is still there. It is dying, though, and it's dying fast. The idea that being Irish to be Irish is to be Catholic, it is very much a part of the older generation, but not so much a part of the younger generation. But it's still there, something we'll have to deal with. Now, this is Knockbridge Parish. I'm going to tell you a quick story. Now, in light of Hebrews 9, 24 through 28, listen to where would you go if you lived in this village. Knockbridge is a tiny little village. It has come upon some hard times lately. There's been suicides. There's been accidents that have led to death. And they turn. People are asking, why is all this happening? What's going on? And so they're turning. Knockbridge Parish is the only religious establishment in all of the community, in all of Knockbridge. This is it right here, Knockbridge Parish. And it's run by this man, Father Gerard McGinnity. He's the priest of Knockbridge Parish. And so he is the religious authority, if you will, of this community. So people are asking, why is all this happening? What's going on? They come to him. Here is his answer. Here's his answer. He says, if you buy this trinket for 300 euro, bad luck will stay away. He does not have a gospel of hope. He does not have a Christ who can intercede on their behalf to give them hope. He says, buy this trinket for 300 euro, and bad luck will stay away from you. That's it. There's nobody else to offer them anything. There's one Christian in the community who moved there from South Africa, and while we were there, we had the first prayer meeting at Knockbridge because she had a burden for a community, and we were talking, and the last known convert to Christianity from Knockbridge was one man in 1980. That is the last Christian anybody can remember coming from Knockbridge. And so they have this man, Father Gerard McGinnity, offering them trinkets for 300 euro to stave off bad luck, but it gets worse than that. He follows this non-Roman Catholic sanctioned cult called Our Lady Queen of Peace, started by an Irish lady named Christine who had this vision of Mary. Mary told her to paint this painting that you see here, put it in a house, and this house will be a house of prayer for all people. Priests and lay people alike can come and pray to Mary and worship her, and so she does this. Well, Father Gerard McGinnity serves as her spiritual advisor. And this lady, Christine, has since claimed to be a prophetess. She claims to have prophesied of 9/11, suffers from stigmata on her hands and feet. And so this is the man, this is the religious authority in the community that these people have to turn to. There's nobody else. That's it. Where is their hope? When they're face to face with death, they look for hope. Nobody is there to point them to Christ, to a gospel. You're pointed to a trinket. Spend 300 euro, which is a lot of money, which does nothing. And so Catholicism is still there, but like I said, it's on the decline. Nobody's going to mass. Nobody going to the churches, and so they're being put up for sale. They're turned into apartments, to businesses, or they're turned into mosques. Ireland has a Muslim population of about 2 to 2.2%. So it's still small, but if you think about it, if the Muslim population is 2%, that still means Muslims outnumber evangelicals 2-1. So that's the first one. Catholicism is still there, something we'll have to deal with, but it's dying fast. And what gets put in its place is atheism, materialism. This is an article, a little blurb anyway, from an Irish newspaper. And let me read it to you. It says, issue is religion. If men could get pregnant, there would be abortion on demand. There would be an abortion clinic on every corner, and abortion would be free. The issue is not about the right to life of the unborn, but about religion controlling women, sex, and reproduction. Now, this is very interesting because what this little thing is telling you has nothing to do about abortion. Has nothing to do with abortion. It is exactly what the title says. The issue is religion. Because of all of the scandals in the Roman Catholic Church, the abuse, any religion just gets grouped into a big pool, and it's you guys are the problem. Leave us alone. Don't give us religion. Let us have our secular atheist society and everything will be okay. The issue is religion. And so that is where people are turning to atheism, secularism. Last year in 2013, they passed a law to allow secular weddings. You used to have to either be married in a church or you would get married. You would basically go to the county clerk and sign papers and you were married. You couldn't have a ceremony. Well, now they're allowing ceremonies to take place, secular ceremonies. And they interviewed one Irish bride as to why she wanted a secular ceremony and not a church wedding. And she said, or she told the reporter, she said, growing up, I went to a lot of weddings, and those weddings all tended to be about Jesus, and I don't want anything to do with him. And that's very telling. You know, forget the fact that marriage is a picture of Christ in the church, that it is an institution established at creation by God himself. We don't want anything to do with that. Let us be. Well, they also passed a law to legalize abortion under certain circumstances. Now, you know, whether the circumstances are... Once you allow it and you start allowing circumstances, the lines are easily blurred, and it is not long before the ball just rolls down and it's legalized completely. So the island is growing in a secular fashion very fast. This was also very interesting. Last year they gave a survey to Irish men and women, and they asked them to rank 119 issues of what is most important to them to what is most least important to them as to how it affects their life, who they are as Irish men and women, what is most important, what is least important. 119 issues, religion was one of them. I don't know if I said write down 119 issues that affect you or are important to you, if you could come up. I couldn't come up with 119, I don't know. But religion is one of these. Here are the top 10. Quality of education, literacy, universities, third level, early child development, libraries, air quality, numeracy levels, home life of kids and young people, education, lifelong learning. So lots of education in the top 10, right? Lots of education. Well, where did religion rank? Religion didn't make the top 10, obviously. It didn't make the top 30. It didn't even make the top 75. Religion didn't even make the top 100. You know where religion came in? Dead last. It came in dead last, which means, basically, religion has no effect. It is not important in my life at all. Of 119 issues, religion comes in dead last. That basically tells you God is unimportant. We don't care. Air quality is more important than a relationship with God. 119 issues. Well, that's the second one. And then you have this. This is a picture I took out of the backyard of a godly Christian man. And you can see how everything around it looks nice and mowed, except for that one little plot of land, that green plot there. Let's see. No, okay. That plot of land is untouched because of that one thing right there, that one tree that stands alone by itself. That lone tree is called a fairy tree. And if you touch a fairy tree, bad luck will come to you. So you'll drive down the road and you'll see plots of land that look plowed, that look taken care of, but inevitably there's a plot of land untouched because there's one tree that stands alone, and that's a fairy tree. And inevitably it's a self-fulfilling prophecy because you chop it down, you do anything to it, and anything remotely bad happens, everybody's going to say, you touched the fairy tree. You see? You shouldn't have done that. So superstition is so ingrained into who they are and how they think. And this was taken out of the backyard of a Christian man. And so it's help, you know, it's not just, you've got to kind of help them see how does this superstition fit into the biblical worldview now that you're a Christian? But there is so much superstition there. This is just one of them. So those three things, Catholicism, atheism, secularism, superstition, are all intermingled and all fighting out for supremacy of who's going to win, what's going to take over and be dominant. And right now, atheism, I think, is on the rise. I just want to show you a little bit about where we'll be and who we'll be with. So on the East Coast, kind of halfway through, you see Dublin down at the bottom there. You go straight up to about an hour, you'll reach Dundalk, which is where that A, the red A, is. Dundalk is where the Baptist church is that we'll be attending while we're there. Outlined in red is the county. So Ireland is divided up into counties. This is County Louth. I just wanted to show you a little bit of where the churches are in this county. You have two churches down south in Drogheda, a Presbyterian church and a charismatic church. You have three in Dundalk, a Baptist church, a Presbyterian church, and a Pentecostal church. And that's it. That means there's one church for every 23,000 people in this county alone. One church for every 23,000 people. And that doesn't tell you the whole story because there are two in Drogheda and three in Dundalk. There's nothing in the middle. There's nothing on that little peninsula there. And nobody's going to drive usually that far to go to a church. With our friends who are there, they live 10 minutes away from their work and they drive to work and people tell them, why do you guys drive so far to work? 10 minutes. The idea of driving long distances is not there. I think part of that is because gas is $10 a gallon or so. But that's it. So there's nothing in the middle. There's nothing on the peninsula. There's one church for every 23,000 people in this county. Here's the church that we'll be attending, Dundalk Baptist Church. It's an old railroad station that has been partitioned off and sold it into units, and they bought one of the units. That's the inside. These three, and I just want to show you some members of the church. The young woman in blue, standing there looking very cold, is about to be baptized. This was in September of 2008. Were you there, Smalls?
Yeah.
Okay, so 2010, I guess. September in Ireland, wanting to be baptized in the ocean. She was nuts. It was probably, I mean, you can see how everybody's dressed. You see the guy in the middle there. The water had to have been maybe 20 degrees, I imagine. It was cold, but she did it, and we were excited and thankful, and it was a good time. The young man in the middle is Rory. He just graduated from the university this past year. And the gentleman on your right, far right, is Kevin Marley. He's a good friend of mine. He fills in for the pastor a lot when he is away. These are the O'Hares. I like these pictures because I think it appropriately represents them. They're just fun people. I think they are who these pictures show them that they are. They have a son, Joshua, that I don't have a picture of. Colin, the dad and husband there, the first time I met him, he's very nice, but he has a very strong Irish accent, and he said something to me that even to this day I'm still not sure how to appropriately respond to. Because he'll come up to me and say, "Hey, Michael, how's the crack?" And, you know, my initial response is, "Well, you know, I'm a Christian, we don't really do that." But it's like, how's the crack? Crack is C-R-A-I-C. How's the crack? It means, Michael, you know, how are you doing? Or if they say, where's the crack? It means like, where's the good time? How was the party, basically? So how's the crack? You know, what's going on? So even though I know what it means, even now when he says it, I'm still like, how do I rightly respond to it? So the gentleman in the middle in the gray suit is Stephen Murphy, the pastor of the church. The lady in blue is his wife, Marie. Their son on your far right is Daniel, and he is married to the girl in the middle between Stephen and Marie, and that's Chastity, and they have a little boy, Elijah, that Daniel is holding. Chastity, well, Daniel came to the U.S. to go to college, and he met Chastity there in Mississippi. And she, Chastity is from Biloxi, and they got married, they moved to Ireland, and being from Biloxi, she had a strong southern accent. So when she moved to Ireland, she said not a single Irish person could understand a word she was saying because she had such a strong southern accent. So she's worked over the past 5 years or so to bring her accent down so she can be understood. The gentleman in red is named Philip. He's a member of the church. The guy in black, the man in black, is Mick. Mick McShane. He is a former British naval cook. And he does not live in Dundalk. He actually lives in Carlingford. Mick suffers from chronic fatigue syndrome, which means that he can only stand for about a minute. Otherwise, he is basically lying in bed for the next 3 days. So he gets around the village in a little motorized scooter. And he's the only Christian in the village that we know of. And he hands out tracts and tries to talk to people. But because he suffers from chronic fatigue syndrome, he doesn't go to church almost ever because then he's lying in bed for the next month. So he is the only one in this little village of Carlingford. Now, before I talk about Carlingford, right now there are two areas that we are looking at to hopefully work and plant a church. You can see Dundalk there, so remember Dublin is about an hour south. One of the places is in between Dundalk and Dublin, a place kind of in the middle there where I said there were no churches in the middle. That's one place where we're looking to start a church. There are several benefits of looking down there and maybe trying to work in there. But there's also, we can talk about those if you like, there's also Carlingford. This entire peninsula called the Cooley Peninsula, there's nothing going on here. There's no church anywhere on this peninsula. And in Carlingford in particular, there's only one Christian that we know of, and that's Mick. So this is the other place that we're looking for, or looking at. I just thought I'd show you one of the places here. This is Carlingford. It's very beautiful. You can see the main road there on the side. The actual road in between the village is the road that was stone road made during the 14th, 15th century. You can see the castle kind of off on your right, I guess it would be. That's a King John or Prince John's castle from Robin Hood. He had that built. There's another outpost kind of closer to us. And so it's very beautiful. You've got the mountains going behind it. You've got Carlingford Bay out in front of it. You've got these castles. It's very picturesque. And what that does is during festival times, it brings in a lot of people from Eastern Europe who are a part of the occult and are Wiccans and New Age mystics and Neo-Druids. And so you have a lot of this gathering for the festivals of these types of people who believe these basically pagan religions. Very quickly, I think it was somewhere around 2004, they were doing a census, and they counted there was roughly about 3,300 Baptists in all of Ireland. Well, there were also roughly 3,300 Neo-Druids in Ireland. And so the number of Druids equaled the number of Baptists at that time. Here are just two more pictures. You've got King John's Castle again, Carlingford Bay. They say they have two weather forecasts there. Either it's raining or it's about to rain. So you can see in the picture on your right there, we had a good 10 minutes of sun. So it was a good day. We got to see the blue sky for a second. What are the gospel difficulties? These are the difficulties that I foresee us coming in contact with. The first is what I've called the historical problem. Every time a Protestant gospel has come to Ireland, it's come from Britain. And it comes first with the Scots Presbyterians coming into Northern Ireland. It comes with Cromwell and a sword under a British flag. And so Protestantism, a true saving gospel, comes to them with this British identity. And so because of this history, even though it's happened a long time ago, that has shaped how they think and how they view what it is to believe a saving gospel. And what it is to, well, we have to deny our Irishness and become British. So their history has shaped who they are and how they view the gospel based on how it has come to them in the past. And it very much affects even people that you talk to today. And so that historical problem, tied in with the identity of problem, that is, to be Irish was to be Catholic, and if you want me to be a Protestant, then I have to become British because I have to abandon my whole identity to accept that gospel. How do you make these divisions and say, you can be Irish, but be Irish for the glory of God, believing a saving gospel? To be Irish is to be Catholic and is to, you know, create this identity circle that's not just national but religious and political. A lot of times, if somebody says, "Well, they're Catholic," that may say more about what their political beliefs than their religious beliefs. And so there's this identity problem they have to work with. The other that I mentioned before is the jaded problem. There's just been so much abuse and sexual scandals in the Roman Catholic Church that people are fed up with religion as a whole. So it doesn't matter what you believe. It's just, you're religious, you're all the same. Hypocrites, you know, put them off on the side. The issue is religion, just like that article said. And last one is the secular problem. So if you're abandoning everything, where do you turn? Well, you turn to atheism, naturalistic materialism, secularism. And that's what's happening. It's odd that you have a growing number of people who are following atheism. At the same time, you have this slow rise of ancient pagan religions like Druidism. There's nobody there to do the work. There's nobody there to offer an actual saving gospel that can provide any hope. Briefly, just tell you where we are in our support. We have to raise roughly $7,600 a month. You can see the breakdown, at least of 56%, what it all goes to. I probably should include that, you know, when you go from dollars to euro, the euro is better than the dollar. So we actually lose a quarter of what we raise just in transferring it to euros. So chop that down by a quarter, and then you can see 56% of that goes to those four things. Officially, we're at 50% of our goal. I wrote officially in quotes because we've had some people who are going to support us. They just haven't told us how much. And all of the past three Lord's days, I've been gone to other churches, and it seems like those churches are going to want to support us as well. So that doesn't include what they will contribute. So that's where we are. We need roughly 3,800 more a month. You can see support levels just to show, you know, if we had 76 more supporters at 50 a month, we'd be done, or 19 at 200 a month, we'd be done. Let me just say just a couple things on these two slides really quick. You know, the longer I've been doing this and have listened to other missionaries and have really thought about what is going on and how does missions work, I am firmly convinced that the success of the advancement of the kingdom of God is not primarily done on the people who go, but by the people who send. That it is accomplished mostly in churches like this, in rooms like this, where the people who participate in the going, who are on their knees praying for those whom they send out, and who are supporting them, that is where the advancement primarily takes place. It's when people in rooms like this who pray to God and God answers their prayers and does something on the other side that things get accomplished. The people who go out, they may do the handwork, but it's because of the prayers of people back on this side in rooms like this who are sending up prayers to God, and he hears them and he answers them and does work on that other side. And so don't just hear this little thing about Ireland and think, well, you know, okay, he's going to go do some work and, you know, good for the gospel. It will fail if we do not have people on this side praying and supporting us. If anybody is interested in being a part of our support team or wants to be on our email list, I try to send an update every 4 to 6 weeks or so. Just come up to me afterward and get your name and email and I'll add you. But if you would like to be a part of our support team, let me know and we'd love to have you be a part of that with us. Where we are very quickly, we spent last summer living in Ireland. I took my whole family. We had a little cottage. We had a car. We wanted to see, okay, how much is it going to cost to live here? What is it going to be like? And we learned quickly that it's not America. It's not America. Gas is $9, $10 a gallon, so you really don't drive very far often. Ashley learned that doing the clothes in a dishwasher, or not dishwasher, you don't do clothes in a dishwasher, in a washing machine, is very different. Their washing machines were probably stood, you know, that tall, and I think she said she washed like 2 towels in the wash cycle. It took 4 hours. And then drying them, they never got dry. So we ended up having to put out the clothesline and hang them on the clothesline. And I always wonder, how do they get anything dry? Because you know in 10 minutes, it's going to storm and it's going to downpour. So how does anything ever get dry? I still don't know. I'm assuming they have a secret way that we have not yet known. But so it was interesting. You don't go to Walmart to buy everything. You go to a butcher, you get your meat. You can go to a baker to get your bread. You can go to fruit stands to get fruit and things like that. So it's very different. One of the most popular questions I was asked while I've been there is, what is Walmart like? The idea of a store where you can buy food and toys and paint and guns and have your car service and electronics blows their minds. I think they can't understand what kind of store is that. So I always thought one of them came and visited us and we took them to Sam's Club, that might be a dangerous thing, so I'm afraid their minds might start melting or something. But we did that. We tried to learn what it would be like to live there. You can see some of the churches we visited, or at least that I've gone to most of them. Ashley and my family have come to a few of them there. So we've been all over. We're still in the middle of raising startup costs and raising support. So that's the end. Before I ask for questions, let me tell you a very quick story, and then I'll ask if there are any questions. I know we've got to end here soon, but just to tell you also how the Christian life can also be a witness. In Ireland, deaths are more celebratory, I guess, than birthdays are. And they have wakes. And several years ago, Marie Murphy, the pastor's wife, her father died. and they had a wake. And so his body was in his house for 2 days. And you're supposed to feed the people who come into the house to pay their respects. And over the course of 2 days, they had 1,000 people come in. And they had people from not just Ireland, but there was a priest from New Jersey who flew in to go to his wake. Well, her mom, who was not a Christian, knew that there was probably going to be a lot of people. So she asked Marie, said, do you think that your church would be able to help out? And she said, of course. And so for 2 days, 1,000 people are coming in and out of this house, paying their respects. And her mom, who's not a Christian, by the end of it, saw there was a difference between the people who would come visit and the people who were in the kitchen. She saw the priests who were walking around wanting people to listen to their every word, wanting people to hang on them and to hear what they had to say. And then she saw these Christians, these Baptists, who for 2 days were in the kitchen serving 1,000 people, coming in and out, taking out trash, taking out garbage, bringing in food, taking cups. And she saw there was a difference between these Baptists and these priests who want people to follow them, and these Christians who did nothing but serve 1,000 people for 2 days. She's still not a Christian. But for that moment, she saw there was a difference. And so it's just a testimony to how even living the Christian life and living a life of what it means to be a servant can have a powerful witness to those around us. I'll go ahead and stop there and just ask if there are any questions. I could keep talking, but you guys may have some questions. Sir?
Let me begin. I've already said you would want to live for the rest of your life, but realistically, how long do you anticipate it would take to get a work up and going?
Right. Everything moves so slowly in Ireland. We are going with a vision that we may not see a church going and functioning for maybe 20 years. So this initial leg is a 20-year vision. We hope that we'll be there forever. That's our goal, as long as we can maintain the funding. And we're trying to work ways of which, I'll get back to that in a second. So our plan is a 20-year vision before something gets started. And I think that's probably realistic. If we go with a vision, say, 5 years, we're going to have a church up and running, there's going to be a pastor, it's not going to happen. We'll end up getting disappointed and frustrated and depressed. And people back here who are supporting us have been saying, why aren't they doing anything? I think we need to be realistic of how does this culture work? It's just a slow culture, and it's a very hard culture. The history, its own history, has put up blockades to hearing a gospel. So we are going with a 20-year vision, and hopefully longer after that. Having said that, let me jump back to support now. As long as funding holds out, we're going to be there. One of the reasons to instead look at Carlingford but look south of Dundalk is we'll be closer to a university there. And actually, 2 weeks ago tomorrow, I had a meeting with Bodie Bachum. I don't know if you're familiar with Bodie Bachum, but he and actually another pastor and professor I had spoken to about this, he said, look, there's a university down there. Go finish your PhD, get into the university. They'll hire you because I cannot get a job in Ireland. Irish jobs are for Irish citizens. So I cannot legally get a job there, but I can go to school and they can hire me on. That way I can have income, I can be in the university and tell the kids, okay, we're going to go through Ephesians in Greek, let's go to the pub and share with them the gospel by doing class, reading through Ephesians in Greek. So that gets me a job, it gets me into that community, and it also lets me be close to Dundalk, which is the church we need to be at, and working in a area where there are no churches and no Christians. So that would take off some of the burden of having to maintain financial support from this side, which is why we're kind of looking down south as well. So, two questions in there. Yes. Yes, sir.
Well, that was kind of my question. What were the barriers to working within the culture? And I guess you kind of answered that question. So,
yeah.
That would be a logical
question. Right. Yeah. Because I can't work. I can't get there and start looking for a job. I have to be an Irish citizen, and we couldn't be Irish citizens for at least 5 years. But then there's a question as whether or not we'd have to give up U.S. citizenship to be an Irish citizen. So that plays into that decision as well. But if I get into the university and they hire me on after getting a degree, I can take that job. But, you know, I can do things around the village. We can, like, Ashley has expressed interest in maybe being a part of the tourist council for the village. I mean, those are citizens within the, or people within the community who want to do something for their community. So we can do things like that. I just can't get an official job to get paid for it. Anything? Yes.
Are there other barriers, like, did you say 20-year vision to start your church? Are there, like, barriers to a building or even meeting in your home?
No, we could meet in the home. It would start out in the home. There are no building barriers. The barriers primarily, I think, are going to be relational and people-wise. Buildings are probably going to be expensive, so we wouldn't say, okay, we've got 20 people, let's go look for a building, because it's just going to be a lot of money. One of the reasons we looked in Carlingford as well is there is an old church building. The first time I went to Ireland, I was picked up by a friend of mine, and he's driving me around, and every time we'd pass them, he'd say, you see that castle? That's older than your country. You see that building? That's older than your country. And it's just an old nation. And so there's a very, very old church in Carlingford that nobody uses. It'd need a lot of work to get going. But you could buy that type of thing very cheaply and kind of restore it. So, so building wouldn't be the issue. It's just more people barriers. Anything else?
So basically, it's going to be like being a missionary in Dubai without the fear of having your head cut off, right?
I think so. I think
culturally, you're going to be almost a thing or untouchable.
I think so. Especially, you can't present yourself as, well, I'm a Protestant. I mean, that immediately sets you off as, well, you want me to be British or whatever. So it's finding ways where you can talk to them about the Bible and about the gospel without presenting yourself as Protestant. At the same time, distancing yourself from the religious hypocrisy that they've seen in the Roman Catholic Church. It is going to be the same, because they are unrepentant sinners in both places, and they are rejecting the gospel. And so we go to work and pray that God will open hearts, because that's what we can do. But it is going to be things go so slowly there. I think it's just going to be a long time before we see anything. One of our friends who came here to college, Daniel Murphy, who married Chastity, coming here and now going back to Ireland, he just sees, he's like, man, in America, you guys, if you can do it bigger, faster, better, cheaper, you're on it, you're trying to do it. In Ireland, if we have done something and we've done it this way for 100 years, but it gets the job done, why do we need to change it? And so it's just a slow-going process, a slow-moving culture, and so it's going to take a long time.
How can you adapt as an American, doing everything faster?
Yeah, it's...
How is an American going to adapt to that?
It's a very good question. it will be a means of sanctification in our lives. that's all I can say is... You have to go with an understanding that you can't be an American wherever you go. Mm-hmm. You have to say, how does this society work? And say, okay, even though I may think we did it better here, forget that, because it's not important. Because that may be a hindrance to sharing the gospel. I'll do something that seems very slow and tiring, and I know there's 1,000 different ways to do it better. But if it gets an opportunity to share the gospel, then so be it. Let it be done. And it'll be a means of sanctification, I'm sure, but hopefully it will be for the cause of Christ. Anything else? All right, well, thank you very much. And if you have any questions afterward, please feel free to come up and talk.
Thank you, Brother Mike.
Thank you very much.